Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.
W.J. Pierce for creating and performing our music. Good evening and welcome to Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. We're your hosts, Alistair Cross, and I'm here with my co-host and collaborator, Tamara Thorne. Tamara, are you there? How are you? What are you doing? What's going on?
Here.
What is this? Okay.
Are you wearing underwear? Okay. I'm excited. Even if you're not wearing underwear, I'm excited. Because of what he's not. You're looking. I try not to look. Because we finished our solos, and now we can get back to writing our collaboration. But we finished our solos. They're going to be out this winter.
I'm so excited.
Great. Are you excited? What are you wearing?
I am excited. I'm naked, of course.
Woo!
You know
All right. Too bad we don't have YouTube. Okay.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Before we introduce tonight's guest, I'm going to turn it back over to you, Tamara. I want you to tell everybody a little bit about your upcoming novel, Brimstone. It's a coming-of-age novel that's brimming with ghosts. Tell us about it.
That's why it's called Brimstone. Yeah. And it's got good music because it's set in 1968. Not like that stuff the young whippersnappers are listening to now. Anyway, Brimstone, it's set in a semi-ghost town in Arizona's starkly beautiful high desert. The town of Brimstone, as well as the Brimstone Grand Hotel, are inspired by real places I've been to. And even some of the ghost stories are rooted in terrifying truth. And as for the story itself, let me read you the back cover copy, because I couldn't describe it. Only back cover copy editors can. Family secrets. The Brimstone Grand Hotel, owned by reclusive former movie star Delilah Devine, looms high on Hospital Hill, harboring long-buried family secrets that whisper of unimaginable horrors, horrors that will echo down through generations. I almost said genitalia. That's not right, though. Twisted history. When Delilah's granddaughter, Holly Tremaine, who has seen ghosts for most of her 11 years, first comes to live in the Brimstone Grand in the summer of 1968. She's delighted by its majestic Western beauty and its chilling history. But as she settles in, making friends and enemies alike, the nightmares begin. Within the wall of the Brimstone Grand, the past has come back to life, and Holly and Delilah are faced with an ancient familial evil that rages just below the old hotel's scenic facade, serene facade, too. An evil that won't rest until it possesses Holly, body, mind, and soul. That's it.
Dun, dun,
what do you
dun.
Think?
I think it sounds fantastic. And I happen to know it's fantastic because I have had the pleasure of reading it as you write it. And, it's great.
That's
it's
right. You're my editor. Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I'm your reader.
Reader.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
My Boswell or something. All right.
That's right. Very briefly, you can learn more about what we do at our websites, alistaircross.com and tamarathorne.com. You can visit our mutual blog at thorneandcross.wordpress.com. Or if you tweet, you can find us at tamarathorne and at crossalistair. You can also visit our Haunted Nights Live page on Facebook. For more information on the show, you can visit Authors on the Air on Facebook, Twitter, and at authorsontheair.com. This is a broadcast of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. All right, tonight we are ecstatic, as always, to have returning guest, the legendary one and only Douglas Clegg, who comes back for almost every Halloween, I think. Doug Clegg is the New York Times best-selling and award-winning author of more than 30 books, including The Children's Hour, Neverland, and You Come When I Call You. He is currently finishing up several new books for publication. Doug is married and lives near the coast of New England. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Welcome. Hey, thanks for having me. I was trying to think of something to add to that. But listen, I don't even believe that's me. I don't even believe that bio is me.
It's you.
No, it's
me.
But what I want to know is, what are you wearing?
Do you really want to know? Because, you know, I'm at home. I'm at home on the cushy couch in my home office with a martini in one hand, a monocle on one eye, because, you know, I don't need monocles in two eyes, and a silk bathrobe that's sort of a kimono. But with no
tie,
hold it together. I'm wearing a men's bathrobe, my friend, a masculine men's bathrobe. It's very bush, even though it's sort of thigh-length. come on, I'm just in t-shirt and shorts, my usual outfit when it's winter or coming on winter in New England. I try to hang on to the shorts as long as I can before winter forces them off me, if you'll pardon the expression, but yeah.
I wish I had you get naked,
I have some Poland Springs water, and I'm looking at my office right now and thinking, wow, what a mess this is at the moment. But,
wow. I remember the margaritas we used to have when you lived out here.
Well,
in Fishbowl.
Were amazing. Back when we were younger,
where
we could actually drink tons of them and still feel like we were okay, which is bizarre to me now.
Or even finish one fishbowl size one. And then watch movies. And...
I think one of those fishbowl size margarita glasses, I think that was like an entire mixer or whatever, blender of margaritas for one of those.
Yeah.
Quite impressive.
It was. I don't remember anything else, though.
I don't know how you got home, my friend. I don't know how you got home.
Good Lord.
Perhaps you didn't.
I think Robert came and picked me up. I don't remember. Or else
did he?
Maybe the husbands
did
were gone all night. I don't know. He
don't
might
know.
Have, but we made. I know we fell asleep watching movies on the couch more than once when the guys were gone.
All I remember was we watched horror movies. Then there were Turkish cigarettes and coffee and breakfast in the morning. So other than that, I don't remember much.
That's right. Yes, and tomato juice with clams in it. Yeah, but never tomatoes.
And our Sablehand would come up too.
He was wonderful.
I was going to say, by the way, your book sounds great. What is the name of your book again? The title?
Brimstone.
Okay. I like
takes
that you hesitated.
Place in a copper mining town.
I think it's called Brimstone. I think that sounds great, and also I think you do the high desert really well. I remember
in the desert,
and but the Southwest in general, which is really your turf, and so the. The one Thunder Road was also the Southwest.
Yeah, that was the Mojave. Yeah, that was the Mojave up around
and
Calico.
It was obviously you know that in and out. In fact, you and I used to explore parts of it quite a bit.
We did.
Recall, and have horrifying adventures.
We did. Yeah, we'd go over the mountains and find hillbillies in the hills. And then we'd go over to the high desert and find strange people and go into caves that we shouldn't go in. And it was cool. I liked it. The good old days.
And you know, it's funny because I grew up in Virginia, and, you know, I didn't grow up in the hills. But, I mean, I could go to the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I don't remember people at that point describing people in the valley as flatlanders. L.A., San Bernardino Valley is the first place I ever heard where people in the hills would describe people down below as, those flatlanders.
Yeah.
Like they were a whole different breed.
I'm too close to the mountains to be very flat, you know. Besides, I have a Subaru. That means I'm really a mountain person. So
I remember Great Adventures. When I went to Mount Baldy, we went all over the place.
Yeah.
Big Bear, all over the place. That was fun.
Yeah.
I miss those days.
What was it? Back at Lake Arrowhead is where we found the hillbilly with the shotgun and the dogs. Yeah, that was scary.
Yeah, but you remember the time you and I went out to, like, friggin' Needles or something? Like, we were...
Oh my God!
Death Valley at some point. You and I were like, we're just driving around. Let's go for a drive, and suddenly we're in. I was like, we're going to die.
Yeah.
Here.
Exactly.
That was bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
UFOs or military aircraft. We didn't care.
Yeah, we were, but I don't know how we survived some of those trips. Other than I sang at the top of my lungs.
Luck.
But
yeah,
it was luck and a tank of gas, and I'm like. It's amazing to me how I went so many places with you in a short period of time where I'd be like, wait, are we in Vegas now?
Oh, yeah, Vegas was fun. We did that as an excuse when I was writing Bad Things. We went to the tranny show,
Lacage. First of all, they are female impersonators. I want to set the record straight on this. They were great.
Okay.
Now, we went to,
they were.
To, we, Did we go to La Caja Paul or did we go to Boylask?
The latter, I think.
I don't know. And one of them was a little more sophisticated than the other one, as I recall. Anyway, back to the horror.
Yeah.
So your book sounds great. And Alistair, what's your next book coming up?
Mine is, when? Did you say when? It'll be this week.
Or what is it called?
Yeah.
Oh, it's The Silver Dagger. It's a sequel to The Crimson Corset.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah.
I enjoyed The Crimson Corset quite a bit. It was very creepy, dark, and quite beautifully written.
Aww,
isn't that nice? Silver
Dagger's
great, too. I'm his reader. Yeah.
It's funny, when I pick up some of these horror novels by people that either I know or I kind of know or some I know very well, it's fascinating. I start reading, and I remember with your novel, Alistair, the Angel Alejandro, I started reading thinking, oh, I'll put this down soon because it's an angel story or it's a dark story. But I started reading it, and I was like, oh, my God. Suddenly I was like 40 pages in. And I was sort of like, I can't believe how your writing just pulls you into it. Good story, too. I was reading another friend's book, Elizabeth Engstrom. I don't know if you remember her, Tamara. You probably do. She has a book that's out called Guys Named Bob. And again, I picked it up, not expecting anything because I was like, oh, I love her. I love her work. But I started reading it, and I'm like, I actually have to think to put this down because I have to remember what I have to do today because it was so engaging. So I love your book. I love all these books.
Oh, fun. I love Angel Alejandro. That's a great one too. Yeah.
That means a ton to me. That means a lot to me. That I'm a fan of your work, as you know, and I have been for years. So that means a lot to me. Thank you.
Tell me how much of a fan you are. I'm kidding.
I am so huge.
Yeah.
If you were closer, I would take my boxers off and throw them, like I was at a rock concert.
That's great. Okay. Well, they'll be clean boxers, I assume, right? I don't want
them.
You're like, I haven't washed this in a while, but I'm getting rid of it. Here you go.
You'll get what you get.
Exactly.
You'll get what you get.
Yeah, his cat's always hanging off of them, so, you know, he'll be a little bit snaggy, but that's all.
Back to classy side of this, which is me. let's see.
So what are you up to?
Oh,
we're supposed to be interviewing you.
I've had the most embarrassing CV in the world since I really have only put out a few things in the past 9 years, even though I have all these books done in the past. And I've been working on these books, and I love them all, but there's one I'm really pushing now. I'm pushing to get done. And I'm so close to being finished. I have so many books close to being finished that there's a psychological problem. It's not a writer's block because I'm writing all the time. It's a publishing block. Mm-hmm. But this one I'm determined to get out. It's called Hello, Goodbye, Yes, No. I kind of wanted to get it out last year. It didn't work. But getting closer and closer. I'm pretty close to the end of it. And it's set in a town that I based on a town in the Berkshires. I might get the name wrong. I think it's Shelburne Falls. It might be Sherburne. No, it's Shelburne. Shelburne Falls. And it's in Massachusetts, and it's quite a unique little beautiful town with a ravine running through it and waterfalls running, the river from the waterfalls up the hill running down. And it seems very beautiful but also spooky and small enough to handle. And I've been up there many times in the last 20 years. So I really thought, I want to set a horror novel here. And so I thought, well, this is going to be the place for this book. And it's essentially about a fairly nice, small town in the mountains like this in the Berkshires with kids, and a girl comes to town, essentially a new family comes to town, and that girl comes to town and she has a talent, she claims, for putting on seances. And so what the kids in town do is start finding the houses in town where people have died, sort of sneaking in, or if they've been abandoned or whatever, going to it. And as it builds, the story becomes more than just about seances. It's about a revenge this girl has in this town that no one knows about or why it exists. But we will find out in the story. And so it's a story about, it's just about the boy who falls in love with her. So it's a very, not YA per se, although an adult is telling it of his young teenage years. And I think it's pretty creepy. It's a pretty creepy story overall. It's got a solid twist at the end that I think readers will enjoy. I enjoy it. I really enjoyed it. I began writing it for a friend's anthology that I didn't make the deadline for. The anthology was called, I think the anthology was called, was it called Ouija? I hate to say Ouija. I don't know if it was called that or it was, no, it was called something else, and I wish I could remember it. Megan Hart is the friend, and she invited me in, and I wrote, but I sat there and said, I'm not going to make that deadline because I really like this book enough at this point where if I try to make the deadline, I'm going to sell it short. And so I'm trying to bow out. Anyway, that's a long way from saying. I'm hoping that's the book. I put the cover up on my Facebook/Douglas Clegg page. So if people want to see the cover, I'm pushing to try to get that out by Christmas.
And it is
well,
a fantastic
let us
cover,
know,
by
we'll
the
have
way.
You back.
I saw it, I think, on Twitter is where I saw it, I think, and it's a fantastic cover. You have great covers, though, but really, this one's really
I have nothing to do with it. You know, I have a, I work with a really great designer, and as a result, I say to them, it's about this, it's about this, there's like four scenes like this, and they come up with something sometimes which I didn't even think could exist. And I'm like, okay, so I get credit for it when readers see it. They say, oh, your covers are so great. And I'm like, not mine. I love them. I'm so glad I have them. But a company called Damonza.com or Damonza.com, I've heard it pronounced both ways. And they have designers that just do a great job on my covers, and they're beautiful. Almost every one of them that I look
they
at, I think, boy, that's a beautiful cover. Yeah. Creepy and beautiful.
Yeah,
wow.
Truly.
Very fortunate.
Love
in that
it.
End.
You are.
So that's what I'm working
gorgeous.
On.
Okay, well, as soon, let us know when you know it's going to come out, and we'll get you in.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
I am determined.
You don't have to just come in October.
Determined.
Yes.
As Scarlett O'Hara is my witness, I'm determined this is coming out by Christmas.
Okay, well, then I think our first opening is February. We'll need you then.
That would be
yeah,
great.
We can.
So,
okay.
I'll start
yeah.
sending you, if I send you threatening emails, will that help? I could be like, are you writing? Are you writing? Are you writing?
Honestly, I would welcome that.
Okay, I'm gonna. I will.
Good.
Yeah.
He likes to threaten
get
your people.
Ass to work.
All I
know,
do
so
is book
enough,
you, and
the
then
way,
you have to finish. Yeah.
So weirdly enough, though, I do write every day, and so my reason for not putting anything out is partly I've been working on. I thought it was 13, but about 14 books that are mostly, I mean, I think the least done is about 60% done, but most are about 80% done. And I really have finished
wow.
and I have to clean up some stuff. But there's this thing, I've had this hesitation to put them out, and, if I could figure out why, I would have won the lottery in my head. But in reality, I think I was waiting something out, learning things about more and more about indie publishing, which I've done. I've taken all my backlist to bring out, and they're surprisingly doing very well over the years. And so it's one of these things where I think I've been hesitant because I wanted to see where New York was going. I wanted to see where indie was going. And then it became a habit of being hesitant about it. So I got to get over it.
Right.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing, though. Where do you think New York is going?
I think that it's not going with horror the way – well, it might go – I mean, listen, some horror novels are doing very well, getting some attention, getting some pickups in various, movie things. I think I read that Paul Tremblay's one of his books, I think Head Full of Ghosts, got picked up very well. A lot of things on Netflix are coming out of the – both the indie and the small press and large press area in horror. So, I think there's a lot of great hope for – how horror fiction is currently being perceived as a New York thing. I'm not really seeing New York publishers create a program for it, which is what used to happen. So I see a few books here, a few books there. I don't really see a dedicated line. And to me, that's a sign that it's a great opportunity for many writers, actually. And but I love indie publishing. I prefer New York because when they wine and dine you, if they do, what happens is you feel like I'm king of the world for 10 minutes.
Exactly.
But,
right.
Amazing. But the thing that's amazing to me with indie is I love being able to make the final decision on my covers. I love being able to, make certain decisions and watch them and see how they're doing. And if I advertise. Getting a return on that investment of my advertisement, because when I would advertise years ago when I was with a regular publisher, my return on investment was sort of minimal because I was only getting, as a writer, 10% of the pickup, right? other people more than that. Because so it's one of those things where I can see sort of a direct correlation between my actions, the books, the covers, and what's happening each day or each week or each month, if I want to look at that level, or each year, every 6 months. And that's a huge amount of information and a lot of things you can glean from that about where the markets are. And to me, that's fun. It's like a hobby on the side. So
yeah,
a fun aspect
makes sense.
Right.
Kind of like arts and crafts to me. It's like being in camp, and I always like arts and crafts the best, right? I like canoeing, but I really loved arts and crafts. And if I could, you know, break my finger, but hurt my finger, and they say, oh, don't go to archery today. You can stay in arts and crafts. I'd be like, I'm thrilled. Great. And sometimes self-publishing feels that way. It's that there's a creativity, there's the decision-making that I enjoy. And so I love that aspect. Listen, I miss the advances. I miss those big chunks. You go, ooh, that's a chunk.
Hey, arts and crafts. I just started reading Tom Tryon's Night of the Moon Bow. Did you read that?
No.
Oh, okay.
However, that's a camp. It takes place at a camp. No, I read it. Listen, yeah. I'm a huge fan of this, but I think I started it, and there was something about it that I wasn't excited about as much as I was his earlier books. But
yeah.
I should get back to it. So. I love the other, of course, in Harvest Home.
Yeah. Oh, those are the best. The other, the baby in the vat. Oh, my God, I love that.
You know, it's amazing about the other because it's often forgotten in the theme of the big books of the 60s and 70s where it was the other, it was The Exorcist, and it was Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby that really created a horror boom that opened the door to people like Stephen King, John Saul, maybe even Anne Rice. I'm not sure, but I think Anne Rice too. But it created a thing that horror fiction could be big fiction for New York.
Yeah.
And and so beyond being a wonderful book, I mean, in some ways, The Other reads like a small novel when you read it now. But at the time, it was huge. It was huge.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It has a small feel, but it's really something. I was a kid when I first read it, and it was hard to understand it. I read it and read it again until I understood it, and it was just always one of my favorites. But Harvest Home, you can see Stephen King must have read that as a young man.
I remember when Harvest Home came out, everybody I knew who bought bestsellers was reading it. My mother had it. I read it. I loved it. And then I was such a little snob after that because I thought what was brilliant in what Tom Tryon did in both books was that there really is nothing supernatural happening. It's a seemingly supernatural story, but you don't ever actually necessarily. I mean, there's some little dreamy kind of moments, I think, in Harvest Home, but basically it's a sense that it is grounded in a reality. And it's interesting. Yeah. So when I read Children of the Corn, when it was in, I think it was in Penthouse, which I read in college, and and I read, I think it was Penthouse. It might have been Playboy. It might have been one of the other magazines. I don't know. And I read it, and I loved it. But I was also like, oh, it's supernatural. Like, that was lesser. And meanwhile, I love supernatural fiction, as it turns out.
But yeah.
At the time, I was very judgmental. I was very judgmental about that.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? Because I loved it even though it wasn't supernatural. But that was an early instance of narrator who you can't trust that's so popular.
Unreliable.
Now.
And also,
that's it.
Yeah, there's an aspect of horror fiction I really love, and I'm trying to explore more and more. In fact, I think in most of the books I'm working on, I do explore this, which is I consider perceptive supernatural or perceptive fantasy, which is it's the character who believes they're seeing a ghost. It doesn't necessarily mean there is a ghost, and you know we know many great fictions that have this, but we have a character who does, and that's the character I'm concerned with. So therefore, we will see the ghost, but we will, I hope the reader entering my fictive world will also say, but there may not be a ghost, but to that person, absolutely there is. And I really like that in stories. And I think in the other, it was a perceptive or perceptual supernatural because of course there was, because he perceived it. And that,
it was,
and
you're
other
right.
people didn't always tell. So I think, and even with Harvest Home, it's a perceptual supernatural. So people, it's in fact, in that, it was almost like a mass hysteria kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I still go to other towns in Connecticut, by the way, that to me, still, if you go out in the countryside here, like if you weren't on the coast, but if you go inland about 40 minutes, You could swear half those towns with the cornfields are the town of Harvest Home.
A little scary. Hey, speaking of ghosts, you've been tweeting about the haunting. It was great.
Oh, yeah. It was great. Yeah. Okay, so listen, I dread even having a slightly different view on this because I didn't love the misappropriation. I felt that the misappropriations would have been fine, except I felt they were throwaways. I know people call them Easter eggs now, but I mean, I really felt the Cup of Stars was a misused, considering what a strong idea it is in the book and early movie.
You got a point there. It was very different. There were several things like that.
It was about Eleanor herself and how she took what the girl and her mother's story, and it became her story. So it told you something about her and how she approached reality in telling the story of who she was. And so, but that's fine. I could take all that. Because by the time I got to episode 3, I was like, oh, the dumbwaiter? I was like, I'm sold. I don't care about the appropriations now. This is great. This is real great, scary ghost stories telling. Then the next episode, I don't remember the thing in that, but I do remember thinking that was good. And then I got to episode 5, and I was blown away because that was a complete movie by itself, episode 5 about Eleanor. And the last minute or so of that, it might have been the last 30 seconds, gave me this insight where I was like, oh, or I felt it was insight, where I'm like, oh, this is the nature of this haunting. That's genius. This is genius. And it didn't really follow through on that. It did not follow through into the rest of the series of the nature of Eleanor's haunting from her childhood on, which I won't spoil here, was fantastic. And then the other characters, not quite as much. And that was fine. And then I got to episode 10, and I was actually not happy with episode 10. And I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. All I'm going to say is I felt it was a misuse of the stage Jackson had set. And I really was disturbed by the misuse of a line at the end of the series. That was a complete,
I think I know which one you mean. Yeah.
Of course.
Okay,
you do. Of course you do. You're a Jackson fanatic. You know that story backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I do.
So, in other words, I loved everything about it. I love Mike Flanagan. I loved that the cast was amazing. I have beautiful production, all these great things going for it, beautiful set design and beautiful lighting or whatever that is, lighting design, I guess. And I love his movies. I don't think I've seen one that I didn't like or love for the most part. But this was weird because I was like, oh, if only you'd condense this down to like a 5-episode series. I think it would have been amazing.
Yeah.
So, many people I know loved that last episode completely, loved it. So.
No, it wasn't my favorite. The later ones I liked a lot. But, yeah, I liked them all except for episode 2, which I will never watch again. I don't like cat horror. That was unnecessary. They could have done
that
with flowers.
It was totally unnecessary. It was also totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
It really wasn't needed. That was the other thing. I love animals, but I know to me in TV shows, I know they're not real. They're not, you know, unless it's Milo.
Yeah, I know
Otis,
they're fake, but I still don't like it.
Unless it was Milo and Otis, that movie where I think the cat actually was killed at a couple of points.
Oh, 16 of them were killed.
Yeah,
I will not watch. Yeah,
that's
horrible.
I was watching it, and someone I know got up in the audience and said, they had just killed a cat in that scene. And she was like, because you can't
repeatedly.
Have I've never gotten over that movie, that problem with that movie. So, but it was unnecessary. If some story it evokes something and we want to see it, but it was totally unnecessary. And I say that as someone who has unnecessarily killed kittens in a book I wrote early on. But I was younger then, it's stupid. So if I had to do it again, I wouldn't.
Yeah. I've never killed a cat, but I've killed a few dogs. And I don't even do it anymore, you know. And they were always ugly, mad, nasty dogs, too. I don't kill household pets, period.
it's interesting because in movies and TVs, it does start to cross the line depending on, is this something that actually augments whatever the horror or suspense is? Or is this just because someone's too lazy to show something scary or something that would have a profound effect, right? And sometimes I just think it's that. It's like, oh, that's easy. Someone's bad or something's bad. Yeah, cat gets killed.
It really is too easy. And what I instantly thought of was The Uninvited and the flowers, the old 1940s Ray Milland movie, and the flowers.
One of my favorite movies.
Wilting.
Yeah.
Oh, mine too. I love that movie.
So wonderful.
And the flowers
by the way,
wilting. Oh.
And you turned me on to that movie. That movie, by the way, and even when parts, you know, it seems almost slow until you get to the parts that aren't. You say, oh my God, it's scarier because it's slow. It's scarier. And
yeah.
That last, I don't know if it's the last moment, but close to the end, where that, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, where somebody new comes in the house, basically. That was
right.
So brilliant. That's a great movie.
It was. That's a got mystery. It's got ghosts. And you can tell that young Steven Spielberg saw that ghost at the top of the stairs.
I think
that had to be
people,
a vision for him.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of people did. And I think even you and me both writing horror fiction, that has an effect. I mean, everything that is inspiring will influence people who are creating more of similar types of things. So I think that's a brilliant movie. There are a bunch of movies of not quite that era, but around that, well, that era to us, because we're of an age where we were baby. We weren't even born then.
Yeah.
But we were babies.
No.
That. But that, the original production of The Haunting of Hill House, The Haunting, with Julie Harris and Claire Bloom, and then also The Innocents with Deborah Carr. Those three movies are really powerful, and yet there's nothing... In the Innocence, there's something a little seriously disturbing in a couple of the moments, but and just to put it out there, the kiss, which
it's
is always
subtle,
shocking.
Though.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean it's more disturbing because it's subtle, and so I think
that
those movies are powerhouses for anyone who really wants to look at movies and horror movies that sort of created a sense of horror without any overt violence, I think.
I agree. And Alistair and I just recently both reread the book, The Haunting of Hill House. And
wonderful
we were
book.
Discussing the, isn't it? What drove me crazy, and I'd forgotten because I had seen the movie so many times since I'd read the book. I call it Chapter 6 because that's where it happens, is Eleanor and Theo go outside and they run across a birthday party and there's a puppy and it's very ghostly.
Oh, yeah.
And see something. But they never say what it is. And they've told the doctor, but they still don't say. What was your take on that?
My take was, my take is as a writer, I'm like, wow, Shirley Jackson was one smart cookie as a writer. She was a smart human being when she was writing that book. She knew the effect scenes would have on readers. She also knew how to create a sense of mystery and maintain it. So even even as Eleanor's driving to the house and she sees those things, remember she sees the white cat, she sees the house with the, I don't know if it has oleander hedges and the white cat's there. And
yes,
someday
it
I'll
was
live in a house like that.
Yeah.
And so I read a great, she wrote a brief, very great, I don't know if it's an essay or it was a speech she gave that was put in essay form, but it's in one of the collections of hers where it's about her talking about how she wrote parts of that. And she talks about how that whole thing with the cat, the white cat and the, I think it's oleander hedges, and the houses she sees where she's like, I could live in that house, and I'd sit in there and I'd have tea and I for my cup of stars, any number of things, right? And the idea is that she did it because it was so that the reader would suspend disbelief by the time they got to the house because they would be in Eleanor's world more than they would be in their own on some level.
Oh,
and
good
then it was
point.
How Eleanor built, how Eleanor built her own sense of, I don't know, grandiosity, her own sense of destiny.
Yeah.
And it's just a fascinating thing to look at. So when you were saying, how do I read that scene in the, I don't know, the garden or in the yard, the property.
Yeah.
I really do think that it was, I don't know, but my take was it was the writer actually smartly saying, I need to build I need to get these readers always on my side. So keep asking, what was that?
Yeah.
For it to work. And I think Henry James does it in the novella or short novel of Turn of the Screw, does the same thing, which another story I read. I probably reread Haunting of Hill House 8-9 times in my life, but I've read Turn of the Screw every year I read it. Every year I read that and Alice in Wonderland. But every year I reread Turn of the Screw because each time I sit there and say, he pulled off something that is should be impossible to pull off. And he does it. By the way, he opens it. You know, he opens it at a Christmas or a winter gathering of people telling ghost stories. And someone says, I have the manuscript for this, and they're going to come back with it. And the way they get into it, and then suddenly we're in the first person of the governess telling her story. And it's just really brilliant because there are questions raised constantly, and some of which are never answered in that story.
Well, I guess I better read that again.
But they keep the mystery going.
So I love
Return of the Screw. That was one of my favorites. I know you're not real fond of it, Tamara, but I love that one.
Yeah, then I'm going to reread it with a different eye. Yeah. Because I liked the movie the last time, and I never liked it before. Yeah. So I'm ready now. I've matured.
Yeah. And you know, in some ways, the movie The Others is a reversal of The Innocents, right? Because there's there's a Mrs. Gross character. There's the housekeeper. There's Nicole Kidman. You know, and it's the opposite. It's a reverse of reverse position.
Oh,
which
that's
is
a good point.
Oh, that's a good,
right?
That's a good point,
right?
Yeah, really.
Yeah, I saw it that way. It's absolutely true.
And there's a great, and one thing that made me think of this, because the writer-director of The Others was Alejandro Amenábar, and I have to believe, he saw The Innocents, probably studied it at some point, because there is a scene where Deborah Carr, as the governor's, comes to Mrs. Gross, and they have a brief moment, and I don't remember the exact line of dialogue, but it's something like, Deborah Carr says, well, what about the others, meaning the ghosts? And then I was like, wait, this makes me wonder if that the meaning of the title of the movie, The Others?
Very well
because
could be.
In other words, right? The others are the people besides are the others. So anyway, I love,
I love that.
I love that movie. Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah,
too.
That's a great one.
Favorites.
It's beautiful, yes.
Some great horror movies out there that I hope people discover, because to me they're you know, it is that thing that I think Stephen King said in his dedication in The Shining, where he said dedicated to Shirley Jackson. He said something like, who never had to raise her voice. And I think,
in
stories. And I think that similarly in those movies, in The Innocents, in the Others and Haunting, the filmmaker, the makers of it did not have to raise their voice, at least not much.
That's
true. Yeah,
and I think that's far more effective in horror in the long run. God knows, I love me some Exorcist.
Oh God,
I know, right?
that's one. Yeah, we just both reread that one too. I just read Legion, and I thought I'd read it before, but I didn't recognize it. That was an interesting one. The third Exorcist
never read
was
the
based
book.
On it.
I've seen the movie. Yeah, I've seen the movie, but I never read the book.
The book
is
in Kinderman's head, nonstop. Yeah, I came out, Jared, there's so much Jewish talk in it. I get on the Skype with Alistair and I say,
drugs that you just said there's so much Jewish talk? Do you mean
Jewish lingo? Because I'll get on the with Alistair and I'll say, I should live so long. And I'm kvetching and I realize I'm picking up his words.
Okay. So
that's what I mean. I'm not being racist.
I know you're not. Cause I know you, but I'm like, well, did you have a drink tonight? No.
No, I don't even drink. I pick up his lingo.
I want to read Legion. I didn't even know.
I'm
about
to send it to you. Yeah.
Oh, really? Cool. I was just saying the other day that I wanted to read it because I read the first one not too long ago, and I totally want to.
Yeah, I reread that too, but it's very different, and it's a narrator story. You're hardly ever out of his head. It's fascinating.
No, that's
and,
a cool idea.
And then you will start talking like, I should be so. And all that, at least I can't.
Those phrases work really well. So did you see, or no, I know you haven't seen this. I've seen a couple of recent horror movies, or dark movies, creepy movies, that I think are pretty brilliant, even though flawed. I just saw one the other night called Boarding School, and it's very disturbing. Uh-huh. Very disturbing movie. Got a boy, contemporary times, I assume. I think maybe it's not. Maybe it's 20 years ago or 40 years ago. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. He basically is caught. His grandmother's died. He's never met her. He's kind of fascinated by her, but he's never met her. He's heard some stories, and he dresses up in one of her gowns, and his stepfather sees him, and suddenly he's being packed off to boarding school. Well, a boarding school that will fix him in some way. And so he goes in there, and the school of misfits, and it's kind of disturbing as the misfits go, because, like, one kid has Tourette's syndrome and has been bullied. But, you know, so it's just a weird, like, that's a very thin ground to tread on, I think, when you make a movie, and you're usually using actual issues some people have. But it was interesting because it's a very small movie, beautifully. I mean, the two young leads are the boy and there's a girl at the school. There's only one girl at the school. And they were wonderful. I mean, the whole thing was wonderful, but all of the kids were great. The Will Patton, I think, plays the guy running the school, and actually a very fine actress plays the other person running the school, but I don't remember her name. And it's worth checking out if you get a chance, even though it's got a problem in it, but it still has some cool stuff and interesting stuff about kids. It's almost, whenever you put kids together in horror, it becomes a little Lord of the Flies, which I really love. And it has that a bit. And that was very good. And then we saw, on Netflix, if you haven't seen this, well worth it, Apostle. Oh, my gosh.
What was it called?
Oh, really? I
haven't seen it yet.
I didn't watch it, but I saw the preview thing for it, and I think it looks really good.
Must be great. Yeah.
The Garth Evans, I believe, is the writer-director, and Dan Stevens is in it. And Martin Sheen, not Michael Sheen, Sheen, not any of the Sheens from America, the British Sheen, Michael Sheen.
Oh, okay.
And it's set in, I think, 1900, 1905, and it's basically goes to find their sister on this island to look for her, and the island is run by this, it worships a goddess, and it's not really the Wicker Man. I mean, the comparison is there's an island and there's a worship. It's not really the Wicker Man, and it goes to what I consider Mark of the Devil territory, if you remember that movie.
Ooh.
It's a very, it starts out as Masterpiece Theater. It becomes really dark and really horrific. Action packed, doesn't stop until the last minute. And the last minute is a great twist also. So
that
great,
sounds terrific.
Yeah, it was terrific.
And that was that's The Prophet, right?
No, that's Apostle.
Wait, Apostle.
On
Apostle.
Netflix.
Okay,
Apostle,
I'm just mixing up everything. Yeah, Apostle. Yeah, I'm going to watch that.
Close. Right. It could have been called Disciple.
You were
Prophet, Apostle.
Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. I'm just mixing
them
all
up. There's a lot of good horror. You know, Netflix did Adam Neville's The Ritual. I think it's called The Ritual, right? Yeah, it was a really good movie.
Yeah.
And
that was good.
And I understand, I think they are also doing Josh Malerman's Bird Box, which is a great story, so it'll be interesting to see that. Someone is doing that.
Nice.
I don't know if it's Netflix or not, but somebody is doing that. And so there's a lot of good horror actually coming out, and it's distinguished. I consider it distinguished because it's not just about aiming for a slasher thing, although I'm not against those either. But it's more about, you know, it's some very serious storytelling. In Apostle, it's some very serious storytelling in there in a lot of ways. But it's pretty, there's some things I wish I could unsee. I wish I could bleach my eyeballs, but it was brilliant.
Oh, really?
it's wonderful. It's
wow.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we both watched Terrifier on Netflix, and I didn't think I'd like it, but it turned out to be a lot of fun because it has some humor.
That's a demon related thing, right? That has a demon in it, right?
It's Art the Clown.
Kind of.
Clown. Art the Clown. It's from a comic book, and Netflix did it.
Oh,
we're going to have Art the Clown on the show next month. Yeah.
Is that named Art the Clown?
Art the Clown is the clown in it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the main character.
Yeah.
That was good. I like it.
Yeah, he's going to come visit us.
Really,
yeah.
It's really visceral. It's really slashery. But I liked it. I thought it was
fun.
But
it's funny.
Yeah.
It has a sense of humor, so it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you slash funny, I'll watch it.
Exactly.
It has that Bruce Campbell vibe.
I will say this. Apostle is incredibly dark, somewhat brilliant, very brilliant, somewhat vicious, and yet no humor whatsoever. I mean, it's brilliant. It is brilliant. Oh my gosh, smart.
Oh, we'll have
dark,
to see
smart.
That.
I've discouraged a few friends from seeing it because when I recommend something and they'll say, "I want to see that," I'm like, "Oh no, you will hate me if you see this. You will absolutely hate me for recommending it to you because you're gonna have nightmares for weeks over some of the imagery in this."
Really, as long as there's no animals getting destroyed, I'm fine. I'll watch
there's
anything.
There's one. Yeah. I will tell you up front. There's one. It happens fairly soon, and it's a farm animal. If that's okay with you.
That's fine. Yeah, it's really just cats.
And by the way, it's not done in any kind of. It's not done in a way that it's not sadistic, I guess I could say. It's something yeah. that just happens. And I was like, oh no, am I going to like this movie at all? Because it happened fairly early.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, but they needed to do that. It was an important point they were making in the story. So it was worth it.
Oh, good.
It showed something about the inner workings of the characters that you needed to know early. So it was well done in that.
Yeah.
Way.
Good.
Yeah.
Nice.
And
oh,
I also, by the way, because I've had lamb euros, I can't really complain when a farm animal gets. I feel bad about it.
Yeah. They taste so good.
I'm on the edge of becoming a vegan. Because,
yeah.
You know, once
really?
You get to know any animal, well, you know, once you get, we've had rabbits here as pets. Once you
know the
personality of these animals, you say, oh, yeah, all animals have this. They're not just functions of our appetites. They actually have existences and angers and happinesses,
mm-hmm.
and you just see it. So,
yeah.
Believe me.
They're adorable. I'm horrified. Yeah. When I was a little kid, real little, I know my parents used to eat rabbit when I was probably under 3 or 4 years old, and I'm horrified that I once ate rabbit. They're too cute and furry. Yeah.
They are, a lot of people do. A lot of people do.
Yeah.
I mean, I am still kind of on the edge with bacon, but you know we have local pigs. We live in the hills
mm-hmm.
of the hillbilly area of Connecticut, and we have a piggery in the woods on the edge of the woods, and they escape and they come back in our yard to practically have babies. Usually it's the sow about to have babies that suddenly is in our front yard, and we're like, why is there a pig about to have babies in our front yard? And I will say this.
Oh wow.
They are mean. They are mean.
Yeah.
We have coy wolves in the woods, and they keep away from the pigs. We have giant coy wolves.
Wow.
They will stay away from those pigs because those pigs are dangerous animals.
Yeah, I'm about giving up beef, but pigs, I'm glad to hear they're a little evil because I really like them.
No,
they're my favorite.
On the other hand, listen, I hate even making these jokes because I really do love animals and it always bothers me. And I have to figure out my own morality in this because it's a very mixed message. Although I have decided I don't really feel bad as much for chickens, but maybe I will soon.
I have a friend who keeps telling me she only eats fish and she says, they do have faces. And
well,
like, maybe you should stop.
we have 50 fish in a pond in our backyard that we take care of and that I love and that I tend to. And every time I look, once you see the fish interacting, how they have their lives, and you're just like going, oh, this is the dilemma of being human is to evolve that conscience.
Yeah.
Always to evolve the conscience as much as possible.
It does.
Topic that's less incendiary.
Oh, we're sort of running out of time. I just realized.
Oh, yeah.
It's so fun.
Oh.
Yeah.
We're good, though, but let's, before you go, though, could you tell the listeners where they can find out more about you and what you do and your work?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so the best place to find out about me is my website, which is douglasclegg.com, douglasclegg.com. Or I have a Facebook page, and it's facebook.com/Douglas Clegg. Same thing, Douglas Clegg.
Yeah.
Douglas Clegg.
Okay.
And my Twitter is Douglas Clegg, although I'm a bit reclusive in some ways, but every now and then, recently I've done this, I go right into Facebook and post some stuff, and the same with Twitter, just not as often as I used to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
We'll keep doing it because we miss you. I've been using Twitter more and more, having really good luck with that, so it's nice
too.
To see you there.
We don't want to wait for a year to have you back, so we're going to book
you
tomorrow for February. How's that?
Oh, thank you. And Twitter, by the way, is so much less of an addiction than Facebook in some ways. Because
isn't it?
Like, you read a few lines, ha, 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 and then you sign off and you go, well, otherwise you'd be reading 1,000 of them. But you go on Facebook,
exactly.
And go, oh, that's my friend. Oh, look what my friend
I like that.
Oh, they're writing an essay on Facebook. Oh, there's another essay. I have to read it. Oh, I'm mad about that about me, too. My friends are so funny.
Yeah.
I'm avoiding Facebook until the elections are over.
It's exhausting. Yeah.
It's taken me a long time to adapt to Twitter a little bit more.
Yeah.
just because I'm used to Facebook, and I really hate having so many. And it's like, oh, now I have to check this one. Now I got to check this one. Now I got to check this one.
Yep.
But the more I do it, the more happy I am with Twitter for that reason. I'm like, it has a farther reach,
absolutely,
and it's quicker. It's to the point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another thing that I do want to, before we sign off, there's something I want to bring up about those, both those, is what I do find with more than Twitter, but also it's true with Twitter too, I guess, if I was really into it, which is that I don't need all those voices in my head. And as you know, as writers, you're always putting voice, you're always creating voices in your head. It's like, oh my God, I'm more cramming my brain space. I can't have more voices in here.
Exactly.
I have more voices in
Sybil. Totally true.
Yeah.
It's totally
true. It is.
All right, well,
yeah,
we are going to book you for February. You are
we are, as always.
We love having you.
We do.
I love being with you guys, as you know. If I could, I'd be there right now, physically.
We would love that.
In my sexy silk kimono.
And I would be throwing my boxers at you.
I'd be watching it all because, you know, I'm sort of conservative that way.
I'm completely, I'm happy in my little house here.
All right. Well,
Mommy, help me.
Thank you. Thank you for being on. And
yes.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. And until next week. We wish you haunted nights
and sweet screams.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Haunted Nights, live with Tamara Thorne and Alistair Cross.